Joe McMonagle, Agent 001, or rather Psychic Spy 001. That was the designation given to Joe back when he worked for a litany of three-letter agencies. A lot of people still have trouble believing there is anything to remote viewing, even though the government had a program for 20 years, presumably still has one in the deep black, and achieved some amazing successes. Joe McMonagle says there is ample proof that it really works, that it not only has allowed him to project his consciousness across space, but also through time, that he's run into some pretty weird stuff in his cosmic travels, including other intelligent life. His experiences, though, go far beyond remote viewing, and the combined effect of a range of weird encounters has been pretty profound. He will be joining us to share with us what he's learned and to tell us how the rest of us can also try to give it a try. We'll go to the break and get right back with Joe McMonagle right after this. Welcome to the program, Joe McMonagle. You know, Joe, you and I have never had the pleasure of meeting, but we have mutual friends in common, people who are familiar with your work on an intimate level, and they all tell me you are the real deal. So I want to welcome you to the show. It's been a long time coming. I've been looking forward to it.
Good evening, George. I'm glad to be on your show.
Yeah, I want to jump into sort of the deep end of the pool. We're, of course, going to talk about your remote viewing adventures and explorations, but I thought first maybe an overview, a framework, a big picture stuff. You know, at one point I remember reading in your first book, Mind Trek, I think that you sort of thought that your remote viewing abilities stem from a near-death experience that you had, actually, I guess, two NDEs that you've had, and you've had out-of-body experiences. You've had these different kinds of encounters during remote viewing. You had a UFO sighting in real life and all kinds of strange encounters. And I wonder to know if you've come up with sort of a unified theory of weirdness, whether it's all related.
One of the things I need to make sure one understands is that the near-death experience that I had was in 1970. But I have basically been psychic since I was born. My first experience as in a psychic sense occurred when I was probably four or five, and it was a shared experience with my twin sister. So I'm not psychic as a result of the near-death experience, but the near-death experience certainly opened me up to speaking about things that I had previously held very close and didn't talk about. The near-death experience opened my sort of psych up to further experiences in the out-of-body state. I would have spontaneous out-of-bodies ever since I had that near-death experience, and those created some difficulties for me because I didn't understand them or completely. I didn't have any control over them at all. And they just happen. So during my sojourn in the remote viewing arena, I was able to eventually travel to Central Virginia and meet Robert Monroe, the original out-of-body person, the man who wrote Journeys Out of the Body. And he and I eventually worked together in his lab, so I was able to bring some of that under control.
I guess what I'm wondering is... Yeah, go ahead. Pardon? I'm sorry, go ahead.
The rest of the things I've written about in my book were just incidents in my life that occurred that were probably somewhat out of the unusual or beyond the normal.
Is there a connection between all of them? Or any kind of a master connection that sort of ties them all together and they make sense in a big picture way?
Well, you know, I think about that sometimes, and I try to find some connective tissue. And in some cases, it leaves you with the feeling that things are happening because they're supposed to. But I've not been able to find the connective tissue line or the reason why some of those things have happened. I'm sure that they, in the larger sense, have driven me in a way towards what I do and have enabled me to pursue the area of remote viewing in a better way. Perhaps, but no, I haven't been able to find any connective tissue there.
In your book, the Stargate Chronicles, you talk about experiences in Vietnam, and at least what I took away from it was, You were psychic your whole life but didn't know it. It was after the near-death experience that you looked back on your life and thought, oh, well, maybe that was a psychic ability that was popping up, and Vietnam would be an example of that, right?
Yeah, they were just incidents up until my near-death experience, and then I came to the realization that, well, maybe these aren't just things that happen in kind of a spurious way, that there must be some reason for them, or there must be some capability in human nature that I haven't paid any attention to that is real. I would try to hide them, or in some way I was embarrassed by them and didn't want to bring them up because, you know, people would look at you and say, oh, what are you, crazy or nuts or something. I remember when I went to Southeast Asia, my first journey to Southeast Asia, when I stepped off the military transport plane, I had an incident where I had this sort of flash that I would be getting on a civilian plane to leave, and it would be a completely, entirely painted yellow plane. It would be sort of this canary yellow plane. And I turned around to the guy behind me and I said, you know, I'm going to leave here on a yellow plane. And he said, well, you are really nuts, you know. And it turned out when I left, they had, in the interim of my period of time in Saigon or in the area of Vietnam, they had contracted a new airline called Braniff. And Braniff painted all of their planes in a pastel color, and the plane I flew out on was called the Freedom Bird, and it was canary yellow.
In combat, you had these premonitions, right?
There were times when moving through an area or returning off of a mission, I would have a sense that I had to change directions or back out of a certain area and go around. And of course the men that worked with me were very upset because I wasn't going the straight and fastest way back out of the jungle, and I would always force them to go the long way sometimes, and we'd find out later that there'd be a unit that would come behind us that was ambushed or something like that. So paying attention to my feelings, you know, getting up and moving into a bunker, for instance, while I was reading in the base camp, people were starting to notice that kind of thing, and I always seemed to be in the right place at the right time. So they began to wonder why I was doing that kind of stuff. But
and is that related to how you end up doing intelligence work? I mean, I should tell the listeners that you were in the Army for 20 years, but you weren't doing remote viewing for the Army. Not that 20 years.
No. My first 13 plus years were all spent overseas in intelligence, and I worked for numerous different agencies at the time, and a lot of the things that I did were in areas of the world that were not basically friendly to Americans. And so the fact that I was able to do what I did for so many years overseas and not be injured or hurt seriously was, I think, a surprise to a lot of people.
I wonder if it has something to do with you ending up in intelligence work, that you had a predisposition to knowing what was going on around you.
I think the only reason I wound up in intelligence work is they sort of they noticed me because of my test scores when I first joined the Army, and they went out of their way to recruit me, and I, of course, volunteered for a lot of that stuff because I had these sort of pie in the sky kind of attitudes towards the intelligence business. You know, I was one of the young people that went to movies and saw the James Bond things and whatnot, and thought it would be something like that. And of course, it was nothing like that at all. It was basically very hard work and very strange work in some cases, and was not entirely the way I thought it would be. It ranged from boredom to absolute insanity in some cases, and so you never knew what was going to happen.
No Aston Martin, no beautiful girls, no none of that stuff,
no.
Huh? Okay.
No, but
Let's talk about, I know you've discussed your near-death experience in public before, but it's been a long time since you've been on this show, and a lot of our listeners have not heard you before. So give us the thumbnail sketch of that experience, how old you were, where you were when it happened, and how it changed you.
I was, I think I was at the time, it was 1970, so that would have been, I was 20 something years, mid 20s, and I was stationed in Germany. And at the time, I happened to be meeting with my wife during my downtime from a mission. I met her in Brunau, Austria for dinner. We were going to spend a weekend there together, and then she was going to go back to her quarters, and I was going to go back to work to the mission I was on. And we had met at this small guest house in Brunau, which is on the Elbe River across from Germany. And it's the same town that Hitler was born in, if you can imagine that. He was born over a butcher shop, I think, in Brunau. But that aside, we met in this guest house, and my good friend who brought her there to meet me was going to have dinner with us and leave. And we ordered before dinner drinks. And after I had taken a few sips of my before dinner drink, I started feeling extremely nauseous and excused myself from the table because I didn't want to become ill inside the restaurant. And went out through the front door. And as I hit the swinging glass door of the restaurant, it was sort of a pop, like you snap your fingers, and I found myself standing on the cobblestone road with the rain falling, this warm, kind of warm rain falling, and it was passing through my hands, the raindrops. And I said, whoa, this is very strange. And I looked up, and I saw a body half in and half out of the swinging glass door, and I recognized myself on the ground and suddenly knew that I was in serious trouble. But I had, what I didn't know at the time is I had gone into convulsions and swallowed my tongue. And my friend came out and saw that I wasn't breathing. And so they brought a car around and they put me in the car and he rushed me to the hospital in Germany.
And you're watching this stuff, though.
I was watching it all from the out-of-body state. And I followed the car into Germany and I watched them unload me at the emergency room and take me into the emergency room of the hospital, and I became bored with the whole process.
Yeah, I remember reading that you said that you're bored with it. There you are,
yeah.
Dying, and you're bored with it.
Yeah, it seemed to be very, very plebeian, something I just wasn't interested in anymore. And I drifted up towards the ceiling of the emergency room and felt heat on the back of my neck, and I thought, this must be one of those, you know, very bright lights they have in the emergency room. And I turned to see what it was, because I felt like I was going to get burned if I was too close to the light. And I turned around and found myself falling backwards through a tunnel. And it's a very classic near-death experience. I then reviewed most of my life and all the incidents in my life, which you actually do. And
all of them, no kidding.
It was not a judgmental thing. Pardon?
All of them, really? Right down to little tiny stuff or big stuff?
Yeah, it was like every conversation, everything I ever did. It was very bizarre. And at the end of this review, I fell out of the end of the tunnel and was enveloped in this very warm, very brilliant, and yet soft and compassionate light. And my sense was that I had been enveloped or fell into the arms of what people would call God. And I think, for lack of a better word, never having experienced anything like it, I would have to say that that's the first place you go in that definition, is this must be what God is, because it's a very loving and compassionate feeling. It's a feeling as though you're home and complete and totally put together again and healthy and
you didn't want to leave.
Condition.
You didn't want to leave.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to leave. It's a place that you just want to stay in forever. And I had made my mind up to that. And a voice said, "No, you have to go back." And I said, "No, I'm not going anywhere." And there was another pop, like you snap your finger again. And I was sitting up under a sheet. I was naked in this room. And I looked over, and there was a patient sharing the room with me, a German patient. And he panicked, sort of. He looked at me and got this crazy look on his face. And I said, "Look, it's okay." I told him in broken German and English, "It's okay. You can't die. God's a white light. Everything's fine. Don't worry." And he ran out of the room, and the doctor came in and sedated me. I woke up the next morning, and they had me on a gurney in a limousine with the windows all taped over. And they moved me to a sort of a rest home or clinic in the Munich area, where I spent 2 weeks while they determined how much brain damage I had. Because they were absolutely sure I had suffered irreparable brain damage, because I had been delivered DOA to the hospital. And over that period of time, I realized I wouldn't get out of that rest home if I didn't start acting normal. So I tried to act normal, which you forget, you know. How do you go back to normal after that experience?
In 1970, now, there are no books, there are no TV specials about near-death experiences,
no.
Though all those classic signs are not commonly known. You didn't know about them, right?
Absolutely not. And as luck would have it, the second psychiatrist, Army psychiatrist they assigned, was someone who had had experience with combat soldiers who had had near-death experiences. And so he knew something about it. And he helped me kind of piece myself back together so that I could act at least relatively normal. But when I left there, I decided that I didn't want to hurt anyone anymore. I didn't want to do anything that was violent, or, you know, I didn't want to be angry with anyone. And so a lot of people viewed me as kind of a risky person to be with, because they didn't feel like I could do my job, I guess.
Or defend yourself or defend them, huh?
Right, exactly. And so I wound up working doing most of the things in my job alone or with very little support. But I always seemed to get the job done, even the more risky things. And developed kind of a reputation for being a little bit crazy, I guess. And always taking the jobs nobody else wanted because of one problem or another. But I did very well, and it ended up keeping me overseas another 7 years. So
you started having, we're going to have to go to a break here in about a minute, but you started having out-of-body experiences that were involuntary, right? As a result,
right,
of the near-death experience?
Yeah. They were happening spontaneously, and I didn't have any idea what they were. I thought, well, maybe I'm not completely back. Maybe there's a reason for this, but I couldn't figure out what it was. And I just kept quiet about it. I didn't speak about it with anyone. I knew if I had brought it up in the military or gone to see the psychiatrist, the base psychiatrist or something,
that would be the end of your career. Yeah. We're talking with Joe McMonagle, psychic remote viewer 001, author of the Stargate Chronicles and other books. When we come back, we jump into the remote viewing program and his experience in that. We're talking with Joe McMonagle, psychic spy, remote viewer, about a lifetime of strange experiences. When we come back, we jump into his work as a remote viewer and some of the things he encountered and saw. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Joe McMonagle, in reading your various books, you describe subtle differences, or I guess important but subtle differences, between the experiences that you came to know so well, the near-death experience, the out-of-body experience that you were able to later sort of harness a little bit, and then the remote viewing. All of them sort of your consciousness outside of your body, it's going somewhere else under control to one degree or another. But you say they're different. They're all different.
That's exactly right. In the course of my involvement with the remote viewing program, I have spent lots of time in the lab at Stanford Research Institute International and the lab at Science Applications International Corporation when it moved there. And I'm still connected to the cognitive sciences lab in California. And in all of our studies, it's ranged across a multitude of different areas to include lucid dreaming and everything in between. And what I can say is one of the difficulties in studying this area is many people have spontaneous out-of-bodies, or they have lucid dreams, or they have remote viewing incidents, or what are very similar to psychic events in their lives. And it's very difficult for that individual when they have one or more of these events to describe which one it is, because all of the definitions seem to be somewhat similar. What we've learned over time and what I have come to understand from experiencing these different events is that they're all somewhat similar in the way the information's imparted, but there are subtle differences between them, which make each one unique in its own right, make them somewhat different in the kinds of information they can garner.
Well, we'll get into that more as we get into your experiences with the remote viewing program. How do you go from Joe, the guy who does the tough jobs but is considered kind of weird, to Joe 001 remote viewer, psychic spy?
Well, I'd like to say, well, all that happened by accident, but the military, when they decided that they needed to do, they had decided they needed to do at least a 3-year study project in order to determine the probability of how vulnerable we were to other people using psychics targeting us. And when you have no ability to get into the enemy's programs, what you do is you set up a program of your own where you mimic what you believe the enemy is doing and you target yourself. And that way you have control over everything that's going on.
Huh.
In this case, we were going to spend a year recruiting and training people with clearances in the intelligence industry and then targeting our own three-letter agency, so to speak, for a year, and then have an independent agency evaluate the results, and that would tell us something about what the Soviets were doing back in the Cold War. It didn't quite work out that way. One of the problems is trying to find a psychic with clearances in intelligence. If you bring a bunch of officers into a room and say, everybody who's psychic, raise your hand.
Yeah.
Of course, no one's going to do that because they value their clearance and their sanity. So they had to find a different way of doing that. And they did it by interviewing people individually and finding out whether they believed that psychic functioning was a threat or not. And eventually they were able to locate and identify a number of people who probably were psychic. They then sent us, I was one of those original six, they then sent us one by one to Stanford Research Institute where we were tested in remote viewing. And walking in cold, I had 5 first place matches and 1 second place match, which was, I believe, probability of that happening by chance was off the scale. So I was volunteered for the project. That's how I got into it. Originally, they gave me the number 001, and when they started to give 002 to the next remote viewer, the original six, they realized that by doing so, they would be telling people how many viewers they actually had.
Oh, yeah.
So the second viewer got 382 or 385. So
that's
by
too bad.
Chance alone,
you didn't have a 007. That's too bad.
Right, exactly.
So you showed a proclivity, an aptitude for this right off the bat. What do you say now, going into the setting up the rest of our discussion here? What do you say to people if you're at a public conference or giving a speech or meeting with a group And you got the not just a skeptic, but an absolute debunker. It's all baloney. It doesn't exist. You have no proof. How do you deal with that? Or do you even try to convince someone like that anymore?
Well, one of the things you have to realize from the get-go is that one or two events, or even a couple dozen events, are not proof. Proof in the scientific sense is hundreds of remote viewings. It's the replicability of the experiment or the process. It's having it done in more than one lab or more than one place, all using the same protocol, and then having it all independently evaluated, peer reviewed, that sort of thing. And to date, there are something like probably 350 different experiments that have been done with multiple viewers, entailing hundreds, literally hundreds, sometimes thousands of remote viewings in a multitude of different labs across the world. So it's been fairly well replicated, and there's plenty of information out there in terms of peer-reviewed journal articles. And I would suggest that people go out and read the data and look at the data before they start making inane and stupid comments about what's real and not real.
Well, you saw how when the CIA canceled the program some years ago, and then the study comes out that says, yeah, there's no proof that really works, and it all seemed like it was convenient that this assumption was somebody is taking this program into the deep black, but the people who didn't want it to be true used that as proof that it was all baloney. Address that, I guess. I mean, it must bother you to some degree that you have to still justify it all these years later after all the stuff you've done.
Well, you see, I don't personally have to justify anything.
Right.
Hanging here on the wall, immediately to my right, is a Legion of Merit, which I got for doing 164 remote viewings, solving problems that couldn't be solved by any other means. They don't give that award out for fun, and they certainly don't give it out as a cover for stupidity. So, I don't have to prove anything to anyone. I certainly don't have to prove anything to myself.
I read some of the
So,
evaluations of you in the Stargate Chronicles. There are some memos that you were allowed to publish that where they said Joe got the job done. He did things and found things out that basically demonstrated this is real.
that's right. And I'm not saying it works all the time. It, in fact, doesn't work all the time. It probably doesn't work 50% of the time. But when it did work, it worked very well, and we were able to solve problems that they had spent years trying to unravel and were unable to do so in other agencies. When they brought those issues to us, those problems to us, we were able to not only solve them, but come up with very specific answers to them when no one else could. So, that stuff doesn't happen by chance or by luck. It happens by very hard work. The other point I'd like to make, George, is that the entire Stargate operation, which actually operated under four or five names over a 20-year period, operated year to year with its funding being approved based on its successes. So the fact that a multitude of different agencies, as you call them, three-letter agencies, had tasked us for those years, year in and year out, and we had sufficient successes to authorize our funding from year to year to keep us in business, I think speaks for itself, no matter
Fair
what
to say that some of your results are
agency.
still classified?
Oh, absolutely. They made a big deal out of releasing, I think, 70,000 or 100,000 pages of our material, and what they basically released were the notes about where things were filed, or the transfer papers between files, that sort of thing. The real things, the real missions that were successful and accomplished things that were of any significance. Where hardly anything was released in that regard.
Can you
So
share with us a couple of your greatest hits, things that you participated in that you
probably
were?
the most important one of the most important the north of the Soviet Union at the time, where they knew something was being constructed, but for 2 years they've been unable to crack the building or figure out what was going on inside. And I was targeted on this building with a sealed envelope with a fingernail portion of a photograph clipped off and put inside the envelope. And I was asked to describe what was going on inside the building, identified the envelope, which was that little piece of photograph. And what I described was the construction of a new kind of submarine consisting of twin hulls put together sideways. And it had a number of improvements over the old Soviet sub. And what was unique about this whole project was the fact that the building was hundreds of yards away from the water. So we did the project for the National Security Council at the time, and everyone disagreed with our projection that they were building a new submarine. They said that it wasn't close enough to the water, there was no way they could launch it, all these kinds of things. But we stuck to our guns, and when I was challenged, I said that they would probably be launching it in 112 days. And so the admiral who carried the information to the NSC arranged to have the building checked at 120 days out or something like that. And what they had found was a huge channel had been cut to the sea, and the new TK-089 Typhoon-class submarine, the biggest boomer ever built, was sitting at the dock. And we were able to collect more information on that one sub than probably the entire Soviet sub pack.
Well, that's a biggie. General Dozier, that was another one?
General Dozier was the commander of NATO in Italy. He was kidnapped and taken from his home one morning, and they had a 12-hour head start. The people that kidnapped him was the Rote Brigata, which is the Red Brigade in Italy. They were well known for charging huge ransoms and then mailing their victims back in pieces and boxes and things. And we knew, since they had a 12-hour head start, that he could be hidden anywhere in the east or the west, and we just didn't have any idea where he'd been taken. But I was able to produce very accurate information on the fact that he was being held in the old section of Padua. Described the building he was being held in, which access corridor they needed to use to get to the floor that he was being held on. I was not the only one involved in this, by the way. There was another remote viewer in our group who described how he was being held, the fact that he was being held in a mock tent that was constructed inside the room, that he was chained to a radiator, that they were playing rock music through headsets taped to his head, and he was being kept permanently blindfolded. All of these things turned out to be absolutely true. And based on our information and information collected from the brother of one of the kidnappers, they were able to put together a solid piece of information and effect his rescue, basically. So he was rescued uninjured.
I can see somebody saying, well, why isn't he working on missing persons cases every day? That he should be doing that all the time, working with cops. You do a lot of that stuff,
don't you? Well,
you
know, that's interesting they say that, George. I do. And the fact is that I also guarantee total anonymity to all the police departments, sheriff's departments, state police, international police, anybody I work with. I guarantee that I will not discuss anything I do with any of those people. I don't even talk about who I work for, because I realize that it subjects them to a great deal of harassment for using psychics. I don't want credit for that. I just work with them, and what goes on between me and them is purely confidential. I have done, in terms of missing people, I've done... 15 two-hour specials in Japan, where I've looked for people missing anywhere from 16 to 35, 40, 50 years, and have found them demonstrating remote viewing live on camera, in some cases triple blind, I found at least half the people I was asked to look for and had produced them on stage in Japan. So these are people that were found all over the world. Of course, in many cases in Japan, but there's no guarantee that that's where they would be.
You know, I saw I downloaded in preparation for the interview, I downloaded, I printed out a copy of your Wikipedia page, and it looks like somebody got in there the night before I printed it out. In fact, 2 days ago, they were modifying the page, and it's really snarky. I mean, they poke fun at your predictions, or they say you've made predictions that have not come true. And have you read it lately? Yeah.
No, I don't bother with that stuff. One of the things about Wikipedia is it's open to anybody that wants to make any of those snide comments, and that's fine. It makes them feel good. That's all right. They're not man enough to say it to my face. Most of these people don't read the data. They don't know what they're talking about. They are not eminent scientists. They are skeptics, however. They have the right to say their opinion, and I really don't care what their opinion is.
Well, skeptics...
Too many agencies still to pay any attention to them.
As you've noticed, skepticism, you've said it yourself, skepticism is a healthy thing, especially in a field like
that's
this,
right.
But this goes beyond skepticism. Debunking is different.
Yeah, that's right. It becomes personalized, and almost there's almost an angst or an anger to it. And now I don't understand the need for that, other than in many cases it's usually steeped in their religious beliefs or their personal beliefs in how the world should be. And that's fine. If they want to live in a world where they believe certain things have to be a certain way, and that's okay with me. I don't care.
You think remote viewing was used in the, I'm sure it had to have been used in attempts to find bin Laden at some point. I don't know if it played a factor, a role in actually where he was located, but you think it was?
No, personally, I don't think so. My personal feelings about bin Laden is that through just good intelligence operations, we were able to basically negate any of his abilities to hurt us. Over the course of 10 years, we were certainly able to know more about him than he probably knows about himself. So once you've expended that kind of effort and energy to control a threat, and you bring it under control and you've denigrated his ability to do any harm, the ideal is to leave him in place and let him think that he's as good as he thinks he is. And then that way you have some modicum of control over what he can or can't do. You notice when his own people had decided that he was no longer of value to them and they replaced him in the leadership role that he represented and reduced him to just simply a figurehead, that's when the U.S. government went in and suddenly found him and eradicated him, because he then has only political value. So no, you don't eliminate the person you can basically control.
We're talking with Joe McMonagle, psychic spy. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the more exotic experiences he's had as a remote viewer, encounters with other kinds of intelligence. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.